Okay, let me see if I can mute this.
Hi, Jason. Be careful. Love you.
Hello?
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 A lot of people sing.
That's great. Yeah.
Hello?
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 Hi.
Teleconference?
Yes. Yeah.
Hey. This is Danny.
Hi, Annie. Where are you?
Danny, like a oh Danny boy.
Oh, Danny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hi.
Where's
Hello?
Where is the conference?
Is it in California?
Oh, is it? Okay.
I'm not sure. I don't
hi.
Know.
Hi. Hi, who's there?
Hello.
Hi,
Michigan.
Who's on the call tonight?
I'm here, Julie Forbes in Maine.
Hi, Julie. Well,
hi,
how's it
Julie.
Going? This
is
Kim.
Carlene in Maine also.
Hi. Yeah, hi, Maureen Bunce in Southern Maine with a couple of friends.
Oh, great.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing tonight?
I'm Sarah Grun from Boston, from Newton, Mass.
Hi. How are you this evening?
Hi, folks. It's Ron in Poughkeepsie.
Hey, Ron. How's it going?
Good, sir.
Denora in Chicago. Hello, everybody.
Hi. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hello. Jenna in Nova Scotia.
Jenna in Nova Scotia. Welcome.
Thank you. Claude from Toronto.
I'm sorry. Who from Toronto?
Claude.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
Kim, this is Ahmed from Norwalk.
Oh, hey, Ahmed, how are you doing?
Good. I'd like to talk to you after the conference if you have some time.
Sure, no problem.
I'll give you a call at your 588 number.
That's fine.
Thank you.
I'm Danny, and I'm from Rockwall, Texas.
Hi, who's from Rockwall, Texas?
Danny?
Huh? Welcome to the call.
Thank you.
I'm Judy from Houston, Texas.
Hey, Judy, how's it going this evening?
Great.
Good.
I'm Joan Gwinnett from Newton, Mass.
Who's from Newton, Mass?
Yeah, who else is from Newton, Mass?
Farah. Farah Grun. Who is this?
Joan Gwinnett.
Hi, Joan. How are you doing this evening?
Okay.
Good.
Mary Keown from Groton, Mass.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hey, Kim.
There's a lot of people on the call this evening.
Hey, Kim. Joe from Staten Island.
Oh, hey, Joe. How's it going?
All right, Kim. How are you?
Doing fine, thanks.
Good.
Hi, Joe and Kim. It's Marnie from San Francisco.
Hey, Marnie, hey!
Hi.
Hi, Marnie. How are you?
Good.
People can catch up with each other.
Hey, Marnie, it's Christy in Florida. Hi, Kim.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Paul, are you on the call yet?
Hello?
Okay, well, we're still waiting. Anybody else want to say hi before we get started?
Hi, Kim.
I'm
Deborah from
Mark
San Diego.
Who's from San Diego?
From Rhode Island.
Who's from Rhode Island?
Debbie from Kingsburg, Colorado.
Hi, from
Susan
Colorado.
From Atlanta, Georgia.
Who's from Atlanta, Georgia?
Susan from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you
from
doing?
Michigan.
Good.
Hey, Kim. It's Paul.
Oh, hey, Paul. Paul, we got a lot of people on the call tonight.
Great. Hi,
That's
guys.
Great. It's really exciting. Does everyone want to say hi to Paul?
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul. Hi, hi, hi.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. Basically, we're going to conduct this call the way we normally do. I'm going to conduct a 45-minute formal interview, and then for the last 10 or 15 minutes, I'll open up the call and allow participants to ask their own questions. So I'm going to go ahead and mute everyone out, and we'll unmute you in about 45 minutes. Thank you all for joining the call.
Thank you.
Paul, can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. Well, before I start, let me introduce you to the audience. You know, it's always my excitement and great privilege to talk to Paul about homeopathy at any time. This is a personal favorite of mine because Paul is my homeopathy teacher, and to me, one of the deepest thinkers that we have in homeopathy, and also one of the most skilled prescribers and profound teachers, and somebody also who has really advanced homeopathy in a variety of ways. And I just wanted to, before we actually start the interview, just share a quick story. I had the good fortune to study with Paul, I think Paul was about 12 years ago, 13 years ago?
Yeah.
Something like that. And at that time, Paul was teaching homeopathy, but he had not yet developed the language which we now know as cycles and segments. He was kind of doing that work already, but he hadn't yet developed the language to describe what he was actually doing. And then, I don't know, maybe five, six, 7 years ago, Paul called me, and I went over to his home, and he kind of shared with me this idea of cycles and segments. And, you know, at first I was fairly skeptical. You know, I just kind of thought, well, why do we need to do anything new or add on? You know, homeopathy's been around for almost 200 years, and we have, you know, this incredible system of medicine, and, you know, why is it necessary to really change that? And it was really only my great respect for Paul as a practitioner. I had the opportunity to practice with him for over 18 months in his office, and I had witnessed myself, you know, the amazing success that he was having with very, very difficult cases. It was only that that respect that I had for him that really forced me to go back and really investigate unprejudicedly what he was doing. And when I did that, I began to realize that he had really come across something that was very profound in homeopathy. And it wasn't something new. It was really a development, a further evolution of things that had preceded it, you know, things that that Hahnemann had talked about, that Haring had talked about, that Bunninghausen had talked about. And Paul just looked at all of that, and he, with his very brilliant mind, he had synthesized it and just brought it to the next level. And he basically created a model and a language to describe what every different aspect of homeopathic practice in a way that makes it reproducible. And so I think if you ever talk to any of the people who study with him now, I think one of the things they'll tell you, aside from the fact that he's a, you know, very brilliant scholar of homeopathy and a great practitioner, is that he has the ability to impart in his students a system where they can go out and also be successful in their practice, you know, really prescribe with a very high success rate. So, you know, I could tell you about the books he's written, and we'll hopefully talk about some of those things later on, but I think this is really, for me at least, the thing that is his greatest gift, is this ability to really look into what is going on, take it apart, understand it, and then present it in a format that other people can understand and reproduce in their own practices. So, again, it's my just tremendous pleasure, Paul, to welcome you to the call, and I want to thank you for taking the time to join us this evening.
Well, first, thank you for those really, really kind words, and I'm thankful that you're doing this.
Thanks, Paul.
So,
Before we get started, let me just mention to people who are not aware, Paul will be teaching he's offering a seminar in Los Angeles from November 19th through the 21st called Treating the Challenging Child. And for anybody who might be interested in that seminar, the phone number to contact is 310-914-4116. That's 310-914-4116. Later on, Paul, I'd like you to just kind of share with us about your own program in New England, and maybe starting dates for anybody who might be interested. But let's start with the interview right now. So, yep. I wanted to ask you, the first thing I was really curious about is what philosophical aspects of homeopathy do you feel that practitioners really need to grasp in order to offer appropriate care during an epidemic?
It's a good question. Good question. I think the primary one is that homeopaths need to see that all facets of homeopathy, every piece of homeopathy is actually interrelated and all shares the same fundamental underpinnings. And I think to date, it seems as though different parts of homeopathy are separated. They're worked on separately. They're thought of separately. And then when it comes to the delivery of care, those pieces are delivered separately. So the main thing in terms of epidemics is just to realize there's aspects of it of seeing the whole epidemic topic as intimately related to provings, to normal case taking, to normal materia medica, and so forth. That's the umbrella, the huge rubric under which everything else we're going to talk about has got to fit in. But if we look at what mostly has happened in homeopathy through the ages, it seems as though epidemics just sort of take a world of their own and they're discussed by themselves as if they're not related to everything else. And I think it's in discussing different pieces of homeopathy, that we're discussing them downstream of the main issues, and therefore only seeing pieces of the whole, which leads us to success sometimes and failure all too many times. So I think that might be a beginning part of it, and then we can just dive into the rest of it.
Okay, that sounds good. You know, Paul, I remember, for those of you who don't know, Paul publishes a very excellent newsletter. It's called the Hirsky Letter. It's a bi-monthly publication. And Paul, we might as well tell people, if they do want to order that, where could they, who would they contact to do that?
The easiest thing is just to go onto the website, our website, the New England School of Homeopathy.
And that's www.nesh.com?
Yep.
So for those of you who are interested in finding out more about the Hirsky Letter, it's www.nesh.com. That's Nancy Ellicent Sam Harry.com. And I personally have found those letters very, very rewarding. Basically, Paul discusses a particular issue in homeopathy, a particular aspect of practice, and then he really kind of goes through the whole history of that idea, and then kind of formulates it in terms of his own understanding of homeopathy, and then presents in each letter like a case or two that kind of clarifies that issue or really makes it clear to the student or practitioner how that actually applies to practice. And I personally found them to be very useful, so you might want to check those out. But I remember a few months ago, Paul, there was a couple of years ago in one of your newsletters, you made a number of predictions and about the flu and a number of things. And then I remember reading it, and then a number of months later, like all the things that you predicted basically came true, like right down the line. So could you tell us a little bit more about that and how you were able to make those predictions?
Actually, if we go back to the early 90s, the HAMP used to have case conferences. And in the early case conferences, I think 90, 91 or so, I presented a question on epidemics, a couple of cases of epidemic flu at that time, and then just talked about the issues of epidemics and how they're going to be ever larger in our professional careers and in our lives. And I can tell you why I thought that in a minute. But just in terms of prediction stuff, it was 2 years before the anthrax that I was talking about, anthrax, and it was, I think it was 97 when I was talking about basically what wound up being SARS and the whole bird flu epidemic.
Right.
And if we step away from homeopathy for 1 second, I think the best way to describe it is just that the world was getting smaller. I think we can all agree that just basically goods moving from continent to continent, people moving from continent to continent, so all the little geographic areas and the little biological ecosystems were really becoming just one larger ecosystem. And with that, all the different protections and all the different ways that people and different organisms developed, all that would start breaking down. And so what became obvious to a lot of people is just that we're going to start seeing things in this country that we just have never seen before, and things that are going to impact people that we just haven't had in en masse. And that's come true, and I think we're actually ill prepared for what the next 20 years are going to bring us in terms of that. But that's where the whole topic of epidemics became interesting to me, just that I thought it would be a very important topic for us. Why did I think we're going to have the bird flu? Why did I think it was going to start in China? And why did I think in that part of China? It has to do with the idea that we if we just look at us as organisms, just organisms amongst other organisms, people amongst other species. It seems as though the more we interact with certain species, the more likely it is that we're going to be impacted by them, for good, for worse. And when we started looking at, I guess it was 97, that epidemic that, and this is what I wrote about in 97 and in 98 and in 99 and so forth, that epidemic of bird flu that some bureaucrat in China decided, oh my God, let's just kill all these birds because the incidence of flu that people are getting is too lethal. If he hadn't done that, it just the pandemic that would have started would have been, you know, tragic, to say the least. And I remember reading it in the New York Times and thinking, oh my God, this is like how 1918 began, in terms of that flu. And,
yeah,
and it just seemed like it's just a question of time until those pieces come together again. Mm. And I think a lot of people on this, at this point, with all the media that's been around this past year, most people know how and why the bird flu is so threatening to us. But originally, it's the idea, if you think of it in terms of stress and strain, which is the way we learn how drugs and how different things impact people. If you just think about the way the temperature and just the way different things in your life impact you, if you call all those things stresses, the way you respond to it, we call that a strain. And the stresses can be of many, many types. You know, sometimes it's emotional stress, sometimes it's viruses, sometimes it's bacterias, and so forth. Anyway, it just seemed that the more new bacterias and the more new viruses that we're exposed to, the more likely it is that we're going to wind up getting these epidemics. And then when we realized that, then the next question was, well, where are we in the world? Where are people around animals in a very, very concentrated, very, very densely populated areas? And just came to these farms in China. And it was just, you know, 1, 2, 3, just connecting the dots and saying, my God, the epidemics are going to start there, and they're going to start with any sort of illness that people plus those animals can get. And the easiest one to see at that time was the bird flus. So that became the number one frightening thing to us. Is that enough to
very, very interesting.
Yeah. I can go a lot bird flu itself.
You could give lots of examples.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. What role do you think homeopathy has in treating or preventing epidemics? Or does it have a role?
Yes, it has a role.
Okay.
Potentially, it has a role.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to put a lot of systems in place for it to take that role.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of illnesses that wind up becoming epidemic or pandemic that there are no good medical treatments for. There's a model for how the illness passes, but there's no real models for how to stop the process. And so, to a certain extent, the medical model gets to a certain point and then it stops. And yet, the homeopathic model seems to fit very well in those scenarios, because the way the homeopathic remedy is found is by matching if you go back to that stress and strain, the stress, let's say it's a bacteria, causes us to strain in a certain pattern. We then take the straining, that the symptoms that we are producing through that straining, and match a homeopathic remedy that produces the same exact straining pattern. That's what we do during approving. We do that. We then do the reverse part during the treatment. So when you have let's say it's an herb or a drug that we're going to make a homeopathic remedy out of, when we then give that to a healthy person, they start developing symptoms. In other words, they stress. We stress the individual with a potential new remedy. The individual responds by straining, by developing certain symptoms. Those are the symptoms that we form the materia medica with. Then when we wind up seeing a patient that's ill, either with a virus or bacteria or some emotional reasons, developing the same symptom complex, we then treat them. So our medical model actually fits nicely with what happens during a viral or bacterial infection, whereas our medical colleagues at the moment are stymied by how to stop these epidemics. They try, and right now the closest thing is, of course, vaccinations, which are what would you call it, a distant cousin to homeopathy. It's a isopathic treatment instead of homeopathic treatment. But isopathic treatment doesn't work very well with viruses because they constantly mutate. They constantly drift, what's called a genetic drift, which means that what you isopathically protected against often winds up not being valid after so many months or a year or two. Whereas that doesn't matter to the homeopathic treatment because we're basing it on the symptoms that are going on at that moment. So the bottom line is our model can handle the treatment of epidemics. The medical model can handle epidemics organisms, viruses or bacteria that don't mutate quickly. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have a long historical record, 200 years of homeopathy being used sometimes effectively, sometimes not effectively in epidemics. So I think the issue will be a lot more complicated this go around.
Well, I know you just mentioned this about us having some successes in our history. I know that, for example, we have, like you said, a long history of this. Hahnemann used belladonna in the scarlet fever epidemic in the late 1700s and found that to be very successful, not only in the treatment but also in the prevention of the outbreaks of cases of scarlet fever. So we do have this long history, as you mentioned. Are there modern examples of the use of homeopathy in the treatment of epidemics?
Yeah, and what's interesting, though, as long as you bring that up, the belladonna worked great, and then it stopped working.
Sure.
So the question is, why did it work at that time and then stop working, the next year and the next year and the next year? And then finally, we wound up having a whole list of remedies that maybe we can try. And I think the issue came down to us as, and this is what I meant in the original remarks. Scarlet fever, it's a disease process caused by a certain agent. The symptoms that the scarlet fever then produces, the symptoms of the scarlet fever, will be different depending on that agent at any one time. Just as the organism itself shifts, so too does the remedy that is needed shift. And we know that in every other aspect of homeopathy, we know we're treating the symptom complex in front of us. And yet when we get to something like epidemics, we get kind of frozen in time of saying, all right, he said we use belladonna, therefore we use belladonna. and then that wound up working originally, and then it stopped working, and then they needed to shift to a different remedy, and yet a different remedy, and a different remedy. So the basic idea is being able to match the process that's going on at this moment,
sure,
as opposed to being stuck to any one time. In terms of current times, these the last few years of the letter that we're putting out, everything from when was it, about a month or two ago when we had a gelsemium epidemic on the East Coast and in North Europe, the northern countries in Europe, that was a gelsemium flu. It wasn't a flu, actually. It was more of an upper respiratory infection. But, you know, the gelsemium helped a lot of people, You know, children, old people, everything in between. The year before, we had influenza. I think a lot of people remember the huge scare. You know, how bad the influenza epidemic was going to be and how severe it was and how many babies were going to die. And at the time, and you can read this, and I don't actually know who's on the line with us at this moment, but I'm sure that there may be some people that get these letters that will confirm this, that, you know, it was in October when I wrote this epidemic is going to peak around January 1st, and it's going to be, you know, an average epidemic, and it's going to be, you know, the same number of people that died as usual. It's not going to be anything unusual, and then I listed the remedies that were useful at that time. And so I can tell you, and then the year before that, we did the same thing. So we actually, you know, at least on the East Coast, you know, Florida up through Maine, and in Europe, I could say that we've had this experiences in the last couple of years that were very, very clear in terms of treating the epidemics, treating and preventing.
You know, Paul, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the idea of, you know, some of the people on the call may be familiar with this terminology and some may not, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about the idea of what's called a genus or genius epidemic. It's actually, I've heard some people refer to it as genus and some people as genius.
Right. Can I take it from the beginning?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah, the whole thing, please.
Okay. The whole thing. If you imagine 5-6 people who are going to prove a new remedy. Let's say the remedy is made from a certain flower. Okay?
Sure.
You have 5 or 6 people, each one having a different constitution. One is a calcareous constitution, one's a phosphorus, one's a sulfur, like that. They take this substance in whatever potency, and they take it enough till the time that they start to either produce symptoms or not produce symptoms. Okay? One of those people may not produce any symptoms at all. In other words, their susceptibility to that substance is negligible to none. That person is not going to be sensitive to that substance, period. You have these other people who have some sort of susceptibility to that substance, what you might call a bridge of shared symptoms. In other words, the calcarea carbonica person has some symptoms that they develop while they're taking this new homeopathic substance, this herb. Those symptoms will be symptoms of calcarea carbonica plus symptoms of this new remedy. Likewise with the second person, the third person, the fourth person, the fifth person, and so on. When it's all said and done, that new set of symptoms that are shared with those constitutional remedies, those new set of symptoms, if you mark them off by themselves, those symptoms become the materia medica of the new remedy.
Sure.
So we understand this from the proving part that, A, not everybody's sensitive to any one substance at a given dose, and B, that depending on who you are constitutionally, what your predispositions are individually, you'll develop a certain set of symptoms. And those set of symptoms become the materia medica of that remedy. Now, take the same concept, the same exact concept, and transfer it to a bacteria. So now instead of you taking a potentized substance, you're breathing in a certain bacteria. One person is not going to develop any symptoms at all. In other words, he has or she has no susceptibility, no predisposition towards that bacteria. And therefore, that person is not going to get that virus or bacteria. They're not going to be ill with that bacteria. The other people might become ill. And if you look at the illnesses that they develop, they'll come down into two general categories. One category being what you might call a severe acute syndrome. In other words, they were well, and then all of a sudden they're miserable. Anybody that's had the flu in the last 4 years, 3 years, 2 years knows what I mean. Just absolutely miserable. Those symptoms of misery are symptoms of the flu, quote-unquote, symptoms of this virus or this bacteria, but they're also symptoms of the constitutional predisposition of that person. So, in other words, the Calcarea carbonica develops symptoms, the phosphorus develops symptoms at any one time. And since it's these two constitutions that develop the symptoms, it'll be whatever these constitutions are able to produce in terms of symptoms. In other words, it's not a random number of symptoms that are possible. It's the symptoms that are within the range of the constitution of the predisposing people. So,
well, I just want to just interrupt you for a second. I really like that explanation, Paul. It's just a very elegant way of describing what's going on.
Thank you. So then, let's say you have a phosphorus person who is exposed to bacteria and they're susceptible to it. They develop a set of symptoms. You have a second phosphorus person who is also susceptible because they share the same constitution. Their set of symptoms will be pretty similar to the first one. The third phosphorus person, still sharing the same predisposition, the same susceptibility, gets a set of symptoms that are somewhat similar to the first two, and so on and so on and so on. And so what you wind up finding, if you look carefully, and the problem is, because we didn't have the language for this 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or, well, for that matter, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but if you wind up looking, you'll find that it's only a certain set of constitutions that get sick at any one time. And because it's that set of constitutions that are getting sick, the type of symptoms they're developing are somewhat similar. In other words, the phosphorus person went into, let's say, arsenicum acute, and this other phosphorus person went into an arsenicum acute, and this other person went into arsenicum acute. And so what you wind up find, what you find is that the if you look at a large segment of the population at any one time, you'll find that the true acute syndrome will fit either one remedy or a small group of remedies, but that's what's known as the genus epidemicus, which is the most likely remedy at any one time during an acute. But that only fits the true acute people, and it only fits at a certain time. For example, last year, I think, or 2 years ago, it fit sulfur and then it shifted into phosphorus, that sort of thing. Because over time, it's a different constitutional set of people. Let's say originally it's the phosphoruses that were getting sick. Then after 2 weeks or 3 weeks, now it's the natrium muriaticums that are getting sick. And since they're getting sick, they're going to produce the symptoms that they're able to produce. which means that it's going to be a different remedy that, that starts to come up as genus epidemicus shifts. So the short answer to what a genus epidemicus is that during an acute, it seems as though one or small group of remedies seems to fit the symptom pictures and therefore help a large percentage of people at any one time. And the example I gave, and which was kind of interesting, was in the early 90s, there was a flu that hit the East Coast, and I happened to be teaching, I think I was in England or someplace, and when I came back, this flu was going on, and I started getting a few patients from different homeopaths who are saying, you know, this person is miserable and they're really, really hot-blooded and really thirsty for cold and in a lot of pain. It just looks like bryonia, but bryonia didn't work. And then the next person said, this person was really hot-blooded and stuck his feet out and really thirsty for cold and really looked like sulfur and didn't really work. And it wound up being, strangely enough, it wound up being a Metarhinum epidemic, flu. So you just have to stay open to what's possible during the epidemic and just see that at any one time, one person is producing some symptoms. It could be the next person is producing the same symptoms plus another symptom. The third person, the third ill person is producing the same set of symptoms plus yet a third symptom and so on, and you just sort of add those together just as you would add them together within a proving to find the materia medica. You add them together within an epidemic to find what the materia, essentially what the materia medica is, what the remedy is that needs to be treated, that would treat these people.
Very, very, very well said, Paul. Just because I think maybe some of these concepts might be new to some of the people on the call, I'd like to just get a little bit of clarification just to make sure that everyone understands exactly what you're trying to communicate here. Just to reiterate just quickly, what you're saying is that when because of the different susceptibilities, some people will be susceptible based on their constitutional type, and those people will produce a certain set of symptoms in response to that stress. Let me ask you a question. If there's a stress that everyone is susceptible to, like getting hit by a bus.
Right, that's a species susceptibility as opposed to a individual susceptibility.
So in that case, do you also match the remedy to, do you take, is it the strain as well, or is it just the stress that you're trying to match the remedy to?
It's always the strain. In other words, you're hit by the bus. It still doesn't tell you it's which remedy it is. But the more intense the stress is, the more virulent the virus or bacteria is, or the more shocking the trauma is, the less the individual susceptibility matters. In other words, the example I give is, you know, if you need calcarea or phosphorus or what have you, it doesn't matter if you fall out of a window, you know, five floors. Unless you can fly, it's just not going to work out. So that's a species susceptibility. But even in that situation, as you're shifting from individual susceptibility, which means you can have 5,000 different remedies, as you shift into species susceptibility, you're shifting to an increasingly small number of remedies because as a species, we only have so many options at that point. In other words, if something exciting or something sad or something frightening happens to you, you have essentially 5,000 different ways of dealing with it, each one responded to a different remedy. But if you're hit by a bus, as you said, or if you fall, there's not that many options. You know, it's either going to be the trauma is so severe, it's either going to be impacting your nervous system mostly, your breathing mostly, your bleeds, and so on. And so, and whatever is being impacted first is going to lead to a certain small group of remedies. The more severe the virus, the less it's about the individual susceptibility. The more severe the bacteria, the less it's about individual susceptibility, and the more likely it is that we're talking about what's called a true acute syndrome as opposed to the individuality. So you have like a little cold. What's the remedy for a cold? Well, literally it could be thousands of different remedies.
Sure.
You have the remedy for a flu. What remedy could it be? Literally, it could be hundreds of remedies. You have a life-threatening kind of flu that we had. If you get into that scary syndrome, you know, scary situations, it's going to wind up being a smaller number of remedies. So the question you're asking is really about individual susceptibility versus species susceptibility, and the stress. Being how severe the stress has to be before it doesn't matter what your individual susceptibility is. Big topic, actually.
Because it
also translates into the whole proving discussion, which is if you take some little substance that let's say 5% of the population is sensitive to in a 30C potency, but you drop it down to the toxic level, or you give them a pound of it, everybody's going to be susceptible to it.
So, Paul, I'm just curious. Would you predict that the great growth in homeopathy is going to occur when there's some terribly virulent epidemic that we can easily solve because there's not that many possible remedy choices? And working
well,
in community, we might be able to really demonstrate the efficacy of homeopathy?
I'd say what I said before the anthrax thing happened,
mm-hmm.
which is unless we understand the philosophical underpinnings of homeopathy in a great way, in a way that kind of melds all the pieces of homeopathy together, unless that happens, when scary things happen, it's what we're going to see is the some of the silliness in homeopathy come up. And I'm sorry to say that when the anthrax thing came up, I think we all read and saw it just, what I said, embarrassing parts of homeopathy. It was I dealt with people in those, in those federal buildings and in the post offices. I know what it was like. But there was a methodical way of dealing with it. There was a methodical way of dealing with the people that were exposed, with the people that were not exposed but frightened, and it actually went really well for all those people. But unless we understand the real philosophical things, it's going to be a little bit of a mess. If we can get those pieces together, I think homeopathy will shine just as it's shone, 1,000 years ago, 100 years ago.
Sure.
And what I was saying before, what I was intimating before is, even though we did really well the last go around, I don't think it's going to be quite the same this time, because the nature of the illnesses are going to be somewhat different. They're going to be more genetically intertwining illnesses, which is a whole lengthy discussion.
Sure.
Well, maybe we can have you on for another call and you can talk about that as well.
But I think we all have that experience where it's sometimes hard to treat, just like the common cold that's going around or the common bronchitis that's going around. It gets, that much more dicey as the symptoms get more severe and as the illnesses get more severe. And, ultimately, it turns out that most homeopaths are people, too. So when the...
I see you use the word most.
Yeah. But when your whole culture is in the middle of a kind of a hysteria, it's hard to step back from that hysteria unless you have something that you can fall back on. And it's a sound homeopathic philosophy that actually works is something that you not only can fall back on, but can really help lead with. And that's what we need. I mean, that's what we need as a community.
Well, what about the internet? Can we use that to help us in epidemics?
Well, there's and this is what I was talking about in 93, whenever that HMP conference was, and the internet was kind of new. I think, strangely enough, I was talking during supper with you in my kitchen, and you said the World Wide Web. And I said, what? And he said, the World Wide Web. I said, what is it? And you said, believe me, it's going to be big one day. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember that, but I'll believe you.
I put that away somewhere in my brain, thinking, okay, I believe him. But the thing we need really is, as a community, or what would be useful for us, is to homeopathy is not an accepted medical system in the United States at this time, except for a state here or a state there. But as a general practice of medicine, it isn't. But it is in different countries.
Sure.
And if there's not that many places where homeopaths can make a huge impact globally, except through the epidemic world. In other words, it would be great for the homeopathic community to come together with the equivalent of the CDC and you know, there's a thing called FluNet, for example, and there's people that their whole job is tracking influenza throughout the world. I don't think there's anybody that does that in the homeopathic community except for me. I've been tracking this current flu that just started hitting the United States. I've been tracking it since May, you know, China, Australia, and so on. But it would be nice in those countries where homeopathy is accepted, if they could come together with their medical colleagues and help find the genus Epidemicus, and just sort of connect through those communities and just describe how homeopathy is helping in those countries, so that when we finally have the flu hit in this country, which it tends to hit, you know, later on in the winter, not only do we know the remedies that have been active, but we know the symptoms that have been common, and we see, you know, how the symptoms are shifting, how the virus is shifting, and what the new genus Epidemicus is. And in a strange way, having these other colleagues in other countries working with the health authorities will eventually pay back in this country in terms of acceptance of homeopathy, in terms of actual legislation in this country. But to do that, we really need to have some kind of system in place that doesn't just have a lot of incorrect information. You know, when the whole SARS things hit, it was really deplorable. I mean, just the sort of things that were going on the net. So there's a possible work that can be done that involves connecting the homeopaths in different countries through some sort of epidemic hotline that has substantial good work being done that would help not just patients in general, but help homeopaths with their legislative efforts in different countries. That work is possible. The technology is here. All we need is a kind of philosophical underpinning that would just make it work.
Well, what about homeopathic prophylaxis? I mean, do people have different opinions about this? What do you think? Does it work? And if so, why? Or why not, for that matter? Sorry, I don't mean
How many hours do we have?
I ask these very open-ended questions, but right. You can do it.
Okay, well, the short answer.
Okay.
Short answer. Homeopathic community breaks down into three groups on this topic. Some people that say there's no such thing as homeopathic prophylaxis. These are the classical homeopaths. Say there's no such thing as homeopathic prophylaxis because we treat disease, and if there's not a disease present, you can't really give a remedy. The best you can do is give a remedy for that constitution with the hope that you make them stronger in general.
Sure.
Then you have another group that says, oh, no, you just give this. And that group, in terms of prophylaxis, winds up being a lot of people that wind up giving tons of different remedies at different times and at the very least, you'd say, are not classically minded. And the third group are people that are just not sure and just really want to help their patients, and they're just not quite settled on doing nothing, but they don't want to give like 100 remedies each year for people. So, but the short version of this is actually ingenious, I think. It connects everything we talked about tonight. If you take a bunch of people, let's say 5-6 people, and you decide to do a proving of a remedy like gelsimium, okay? What happens? You start taking the substance, and at a certain point, you start developing symptoms of gelsimium. In other words, we're doing a proving. But according to homeopathic philosophy, right from the beginning, the way homeopathy works is if you are taking, if you have symptoms and you begin to take a remedy, for instance, gelsimium, those symptoms go away. In other words, we're talking about a syndrome shift, a syndrome replacing the syndrome of the remedy, replacing the syndrome of the disease and getting rid of it. That's basically the organon in a nutshell. What we're saying in this scenario is if you're going to do a proving, take relatively healthy people, give them the gelsimium, they start to develop gelsimium symptoms. Now, if it happens to be a gelsimium flu, it has no place to go. In other words, you can't get the flu because you're undergoing the gelsimium proving because two like diseases don't exist in the same place at the same time. This is the basis of homeopathy.
Sure.
So actually, from the classical homeopathic point of view, there's a way to discuss prophylaxis, which is through a discussion of proving. In other words, you find that the genus epidemicus at a certain point happens to be gelsimium, for example. If you decide to coincidentally undergo a proving of gelsimium with your population, that population is going to be protected against the gelsimium flu because they're taking gelsimium.
That's a great way of describing it, Paul.
It actually makes sense from the homeopathic point of view.
Sure.
From the classical point of view, we just never really had a language for it. And, you know, you can refine the whole thing about who you should do this with, who you shouldn't do this with, when you should do it, how severe the epidemic has to be for you to consider doing it. But, for example, you know, if you have like a 90-year-old person who every time they get sick, acutely sick, they end up in near-death scenarios, you know, maybe that person should have a kind of a protection when that flu hits.
Sure.
Hits the area.
Sure.
And if you know that it's if you know what the remedy is, let's say it's a gelsimium flu or whatever, it could just be that if you did that, that person might not be sick. And we've been doing this for years, and it tends to work out okay.
That's great, Paul. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead. Thank you so much, by the way. That was just a very informative discussion on epidemics, and I know that people are going to have some very interesting questions for you. Before I do that, though, I just wanted to mention that Allison Burden, who usually joins us for these calls, was called out in an emergency tonight, and she wanted me to mention to people that anybody who wanted to purchase any of Paul's books through Whole Health Now Books could do so and get a 15% discount if they put in the comments box that they were on this call. So that, you know, you go to www.wholehealthnow.com/books and you could just, and Paul, do you want to just mention your books really quickly so people know what titles you, because you're the author of a number of books, and I think you're also coming out with some books. Could you tell us about that as well?
Well, the first one is the pediatric, the homeopathic treatment of children.
Amazing book, yeah.
The Stramonian book, which explains the whole idea of stress and strain and cycles and segments in a brief way, is a book about provings, and which I think is actually the basis of one of the ways that we suture together provings with, that we put together provings with epidemics and then eventually with materia medica and with repertorization. So there's a book on my take on provings, and then there's another book that actually takes all the works of provings through the history of homeopathy and just puts it all in one book so that people can have their own take on it. But it, you know, instead of spending 5 years trying to figure out where all these articles and journal articles are, you know, it's all right there with commentary. And
a great resource, by the way, both of those proving books, I think.
And of course, the journals that we
the New England Journal,
and
the letter.
And
so
the
thank you, Paul. So and also, Paul, could you just, for people who want to know more about studying with you, can you just tell us about where you're teaching, where your program is, and when it starts, and who they would contact?
Well, I teach a lot in Europe. I'm just jet-lagged right now. That's where I'm rapidly losing my voice. I just came back from Switzerland and then a couple of days ago to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
But I teach mostly in Massachusetts, New England School of Homeopathy, and easiest way is just to read about it is to get on the net at www.nesh.com.
Great.
And
it's
a two-year course.
Thank you. And that's the course I graduated from. And I, again, if anybody's interested in really furthering their studies of homeopathy or really understanding a very deep model and studying with one of the great prescribers we have in this country, you know, by all means, check out the website and give them a call and find out more about it. I know for myself it was a great beginning for me and my adventure in homeopathy. So, Paul, thanks again. I'm going to unmute the call and let some of the participants ask you questions directly. So hold on one second.
Good.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Anybody have a question?
I do.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello.
There can be events that predispose a lot of people to disease, you know, something that would make people need to cry or withdraw or huddle in response to a big shock, a major disappointment. Then the strain pattern would be one of being stunned and overcome by fear and apprehension, a feeling of disempowerment, and that would be... So specifically, can you suggest remedies that would offer support for a community threatened by 4 more years of tyranny?
We knew it was going to come back to that one way or another. Paul and I talked about not discussing politics on the call, but we knew it was going to happen.
Paul,
did you hear the question?
You know, there was a lot of noise in the background, but I think I got the gist of it. So I'm going to answer it my way, which is, aside from which way you voted or I voted or what my political affiliation is or your political affiliation is, by understanding the whole concept that we're talking about, and Kim knows this because I accidentally emailed it to him instead of to another friend, I predicted the election and why it would go this way, which was like really funny. But it made sense from the epidemic point, which is kind of interesting, because everybody was talking about how close.
Elaborate on that a little bit.
What, say again?
Elaborate a little bit. So let,
all right, because, you know, everybody was talking about how close it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it didn't seem that close to me, because if you think about this horrible thing that happened in the United States in 9/11, and again, we're not talking about any political affiliation, just from the big picture. This horrible thing happens, and then right after that, a second horrible thing happens with the anthrax. You know, two somewhat isolated incidents, but they both seem like we're being attacked from the outside, and it is very, very, very scary for a lot of us. And during that time, interestingly enough, there was a flu that was going on. And interestingly enough, the flu at that time needed Arsenicum album. That was the genus Epidemicus at that time. So, strangely enough, a lot of us are frightened. A lot of us are in shock. A lot of us have strong fears about unknown this or that. And at the same time, the flu comes, and the flu happens to be Arsenicum album flu. That's the symptoms that came up. Interestingly enough, not just here. It was in Norway. It was in Switzerland. It was in England. Even the places that weren't attacked, the flu picture that came up was Arsenicum album originally, and then those symptoms changed over time. Now, where are we now in this election year? The question came down to, who's going to win? The kind of people that are worried about terrorism and being attacked from the outside, or the people that are worried about the economy and we need to change and we need to fix the world? And ultimately, it just seemed like the discussion from both sides of the aisle involved the attack and terrorism from the outside, which was going to bode very well for the Republican Party. And the fact that Bin Laden decided to release a tape just then just more or less cinched it. From the kind of epidemic side of it. And strangely enough, when they did the exit polls, there was a lot about that stuff. Which was going to be more Republican than Democrat, and it just didn't seem like it was going to be close at all. And this isn't really about, you know, Democrats or Republicans, you know, political affiliations, just which way it seemed like it was going to drift.
Well, the part of the question was, are you finding there's any remedies? Because this woman is concerned that a lot of people, I know myself, there's a lot of people out there, a lot of friends of mine and family members, close people, who are very, very upset about the results of the election. And I think some people are concerned that things in this country are going to get pretty bad. This woman was asking if there were any remedies. And I know this is a difficult question for you, but I just think
Well, no. I mean, that's an individual susceptibility thing, as opposed to a species susceptibility. If you gear it up, 100 notches, then you have the anthrax scare, and that led to actually a genus epidemicus.
Sure.
But if people right now are joyous, people right now are sad, people right now are crying with happiness, and people right now are crying with rage. And it's very much a individual susceptibility.
Right. Yeah, and so I think that's the right answer, but I think it was just good to answer the woman. So
yeah. But it was interesting, just I decided to take it from both ends, the beginning of it, which was that the first kind of big scary thing that happened in this was that whole 9/11 and the anthrax thing.
Sure.
And during the anthrax thing, it was very clearly an Arsenicum album flu that coincidentally came as we were freaking out as a population.
Very interesting. Hold on a second, Paul. I'm going to get another question.
Yep. Yep.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
In our area, we give Impromazinum in the fall to help people prevent the flu, and this is very popular this year because of the lack of regular flu vaccine. But do you think that makes sense?
That's a good question. This is too long to answer, but it only makes sense for the people that are too sick to develop a true acute illness. The people that are too sick to develop it will wind up having a little bit of protection from influenzainum because they're undergoing a mild proving under that. But the people that would develop a true acute, for example, the people that would go into a Baptisia flu or a Gelsimium flu and so on, those people are not going to get protected from influenzainum. And there's a good philosophical reason why it wouldn't work, and then you see that through history that winds up not working. And that's why it changed every year. People would say different things, you know, let's give influenzainum or let's give just Gelsimium or let's give oxaloxacillin and so on.
Great. Okay, one more question.
It's a great question. It just takes a long time to answer that one. But there is a subset of people that will have a kind of a protection from that.
Well, in the Hirsky letter, you talk about some of these issues, right?
Yep.
Because I remember you did a whole big thing on epidemics, and you went into it.
Yep, I did the whole thing on how to treat epidemics and how it's going to be scary in the near future, a year before that whole thing started.
Right.
And it's letters 33 to 38, I think.
33. Okay, great. Yep. So let's have one more question because we're running a little bit over time.
Question. Paul, when you were talking about people coming down with the flu, I think you were talking about Mediterranean flu.
Can you speak up a little bit? It's hard to hear that question.
When Paul was talking about the flu, and he mentioned that there was a Mediterranean flu that had gone around.
Yep.
During that discussion, you were talking, Paul, about people would come in with similar symptoms, which were the flu symptoms, but the different constitutions would all manifest their own particular symptoms.
Well, at that Mediterranean flu, what wind up happening actually is, let's say somebody needed sulfur originally. When the virus hit them, they actually moved into their next remedy, which wound up being Mediterranean, but it wasn't totally recognizable yet. And somebody else that needed, let's say, calcareous, they moved into a Mediterranean state. So there were various number of people that were getting sick, but as it turned out, the vast majority of them needed Mediterranean, and that Mediterranean wound up not being what you'd call a true acute. It wound up being that the Mediterranean people were getting sick with Mediterranean symptoms, but if you only looked at a bit of the symptoms, it would look like bryonia, or they would look like phosphorus, or they would look like sulfur, and those were the remedies that people were giving, not thinking, wait a minute, this could just be a Mediterranean influenza. In other words, that the Mediterranean people are the ones that are getting sick at this time, but they're not shifting into what I call the true acute syndrome. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's very interesting, and I realize, Paul, that, you know, this is a very deep discussion. Maybe you'll be kind enough to join us in the future for another one of these calls.
That'd be great. You know, the main point, though, is homeopathy has a great place in epidemics, in the epidemic disease and treatment and prevention of it, but it works best if we can have a larger concept of what it is that's happening during an epidemic and what it is that we do as homeopaths and how it connects. The whole epidemic discussion, how it connects to provings, how it connects to the rest of our practice.
Great. Paul, thank you again. I'm going to unmute so everyone can personally thank you, and I really want to just really acknowledge what you're doing for homeopathy. I think it's just a tremendous service. So thank you so much, Paul.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Hold on.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Paul. Good night, people. Good night. Good luck. Jim? Yeah? This is Solara. And hi. I just wanted to find out really quickly, since I didn't hear the whole conversation.
Sure.
Did Paul give what he thinks this year's flu epidemic, genus epidemicus, will be in America?
No, he didn't.
It's Nux Vomica.
Thank you.
Oh!
It's Dr. Luke here. It's Nux Vomica for this year, genus epidemicus.
Hey, I have a question for whoever's still on the line. I'm in Texas, and I treated two cases recently, and I started with Nux because they were just fever and chills.
Yeah. It is
and
Nux Vomica, yeah. It
yeah, and then formica. I moved about, it went to sort of, it looked kind of like either gelsemium and maybe even got into Baptisia, but I felt like I had to switch remedies, but this I should have stuck with Nux.
Yeah, it is Nux Vomica for sure, no doubt about it. I have had probably already 30 cases.
Okay.
And it looks like Bryonia often.
I know,
but
he was
not
thirsty.
Don't forget, Bryonia and Nux Vomica are complementary remedies, so they share a lot of symptoms, even like better with quiet, worse with light, with noise,
yeah.
Irritability, wants to be left alone, the
yeah.
cough, bursting headache, and has to hold the head. All that are common symptoms of those two remedies. So the genus epidemicus of this season is Nux Vomica. You can give it prophylactically and curative, obviously. And talking about the political side of it, I think it's going to be Nux Vomica for the shock cell people after the election, too.
Think so?
If that. Anyway, it's Nux Vomica.
And in treating that, in terms of not the political epidemic thing, but the virus, is it, because I'm new, practicing new, I'm still
right.
in training, in terms of frequency and repetition,
well, basically, you know, if it's an acute case, the best thing you can do is the 50-addition split method, which is, you know, like I say, a 200C in an 8-ounce bottle, 8 succussions, 1 teaspoon from the first cup every 2 hours.
That sounds great.
All right. Well, listen, next week. I'm on next week for some other things.
Oh, is this Luke Shepard?
Yeah, this is Dr. Luke here.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, thank you, Dr.
Your website all night. Could I have your website, please?
DrLuke.com.
I love your new book.
DrLuc.com, right.
Thank you,
Dr. Luke.
Okay, I'll be there next week, and we'll have fun.
I love your book.
Okay.
Dr. Luke.
Yeah.
Tootsie.
Hey.
Donna Merritt from Boston, from the New School of Homeopathy. How are you?
Yes, very good. Well, I was there in October, of course, right? Did I see you then?
No, I couldn't make it. I had
okay.
I was so upset. I really, really wanted to...
Well, not a problem. There is always another occasion. And get the new book, because that would be very helpful for all of this.
Oh, great.
What's the name of the new book?
Achieving and Maintaining the Similimum.
Say that again.
Achieving and Maintaining the Similimum. It's a book about management, totally about management.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Thank you, Dr. Luke.
Good night.
Good night. See you next week. Bye.
Bye.